Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in cultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. It is my great honor today to be speaking with Dr. Hassan Abbas about his new book, The Prophet's Heir, The Life of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Dr. Hassan Abbas is Distinguished Professor of International Relations at the National Defense University. He is also the author of such books as The Taliban Revival and Pakistan's Drift into Extremism. Today, we'll be discussing The Prophet's Heir, published in 2021 with Yale University Press. Professor Abbas, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Honored to be with you.
Could you tell us a little bit about why you decided to write a biography about Imam Ali?
There are a variety of reasons and the variety of inspirations, I should say. One, first and foremost, I have always been in awe of the personality of Ali ibn Abi Talib. His writings, his speeches through Nahjul Balagha, his words of wisdom have always been a source of inspiration. But in this case, I think the primary inspiration was slightly different, this which was linked to my work as a political scientist, as a security studies scholar. And I have been doing a lot of work on extremist groups, on terrorism. And having worked on those issues in South Asia and in Middle East, I was very clear for some time now that the religious extremism that is posing this huge challenge globally is linked first and within the Islamic context, linked first and foremost to the sectarian tensions and tussles and bigotry within Islam. The Al-Qaeda's and the Daesh and the Taliban's of the world first and foremost have issues internally within Muslims. And within that context, I was clear that this is the sectarian hatred and sectarian bigotry in which all sides are involved in some shape or form, but some more than the other, especially in one case that we know, the Daesh and Al-Qaeda. These are the organizations which have been first and foremost anti-Shia, anti-Sufi, anti-progressive attitudes, even within the Sunnis. So I thought I'd write a book on sectarianism maybe. But that led, I saw so many excellent works on that. And ultimately I realized all of our contemporary understanding of the issue is linked to geopolitics. It is linked to modern day states and their interests, and maybe not as much about religion. I wanted to probe this, and I thought there's no better way but to go to the early part of Islamic history. And then the tragedy kind of became more apparent to me that a personality like Ali ibn Abi Talib, who was a bridge builder, who brought people together, who was somebody who was the real successor of the Prophet in a spiritual sense, is someone who has been projected by various Muslim groups as a point from where discord starts. And it is just so tragic because that's not the case. And I thought, in fact, it should be a book on Ali ibn Abi Talib, which will help me explain the essence and spirit of Islam in so many ways. So that's why I reached this point. And then I think it was this was the thinking but it happened also by chance in a conversation with an editor. We were looking at different ideas, and it was my editor at Yale University Press, who I give full credit to heard this idea first, and then encouraged me, and then supported me all the way long. So it was these combination of factors which led to this work.
And what audience did you have in mind?
Excellent question. The audience I had in mind was, I must say, first and foremost, young Muslims. And young Muslims, for the reason that having now, I see myself as a Western Muslim or an American Muslim, I had seen, I have been involved, I've lived in Boston, in New York, in Washington, D.C. for the last 20 years or so. I've lived in England and studied there as well. And I've seen the discussions between the young Muslims among the Shia and the Sunnis have become very intense and have become a very sectarian. And there's a lot of confusion as well. And so I thought they need to first get the message through my humble attempt about the essence and spirit of Islam. Then secondly, it's the Western audience, which is because of, if I may say that, war on terror, and because of all the global tensions and conflict in the last 2 to 3 decades, they have started looking at Islam in a very negative light. When we hear about Islamophobia, not, of course, none of the Muslims would ever justify it, but we understand because if all the big projections are coming from the extremist organizations. And then the Muslim world, as soon as you glance at their leadership, you see in most cases authoritarian leadership. You see the human rights violations. You see internal conflict. And you get a certain image, which is a very unfair and unfortunate image, and which is not deep-rooted in a historical sense. And I thought this, we need to reframe some of the issues for the Western audience also, to tell them about the beauty of Islam, the spirituality of Islam, and the messaging and the narrative of Islam, which is so different from these bombers and extremists and bigots. And that's why. So I would say perhaps equally to young Muslims in the West, but also to my Western non-Muslim audience, the English-speaking, Spanish, French, hopefully translations are under consideration at this time, some happening as well. But the Western audience, non-Muslim audience, is also what I'm trying to get to.
Throughout the book, you use both Quranic verses and poetry to help you tell the story. Can you talk a little bit about your decision to use both Quranic verses and poetry here?
Thank you for another fascinating question. Yes, Quranic, because that for Muslims, of course, it's the most authentic source. And because so much has come into vogue in Muslim scholarship, which is linked to at times commentaries, at times disputed hadith literature, that I thought that if I'm trying to be convincing and trying to be very authentic, and as it should be, the divine message and the center core message is that from Quran. Of course, we cannot understand without understanding the Prophet, but first and foremost is Quran. And that's why and there was so much in Quran which establishes some of the central principles, but also the centrality of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, the Ahlul Bayt. And I thought there is no better way. There are so many Quranic verses like Surah Dahr or Surah Insan, is what is also called, is in praise. It starts with in praise of Ahlul Bayt. There are so many verses about a certain incident would happen, like the incident of 3 days of fasting of the family of the Prophet. And that is mentioned in the book in detail, that the verses came in response to what had happened with Ahlul Bayt. Similarly, with some of the actions of Ali, the most famous one, that he is praying in a mosque and somebody comes in, somebody who's needy, who's asking everyone for help, but everyone is busy in prayers. And Ali, while going down, gives his ring, because that was the only way he takes off his ring to give to that person. Then a verse comes in. which directly mentions about this event. And there's no dispute among the Sunni, Shia, Sufi commentators. They all say, oh, this is about Ali. And that verse is so powerful. It says, your helper and supporter and guide and Wali is God, his prophet, and those who give charity while praying. So I thought that verse, any debate on Ali should have ended by then, after that verse, because it says it is linking Ali to the prophet and to God. And in the same vein, your Wali and supporter, your Wali supporter and guide is God, the prophet, and actually in real words, Ali. And if everyone agrees to it, then what's the dispute? And I thought, I need to start from that, and that hopefully will convince so many people about the importance of this idea or the velayat of Ali. So that's why Quranic verses. I picked poetry because poetry comes from people's hearts. I mean, the rhythm and the beauty and the tone and tenor of the poetry, it cannot be choreographed. It comes out from your heart. So it is across the Muslim history and across the religious or sectarian divisions. It is the love of people for Ali, which has been a galvanizing factor for bringing people together. Ask any Sufi. Recently, actually, just last week, I was traveling to Pakistan. And there was a Sufi mystic scholar who clearly, he said, I'm neither a Shia nor a Sunni, anyone. He had some feedback on my book, and which was a little critical. And I said to him, I said, you're most welcome. This is, as an academic, I'm trained to, and we are learning. But then I asked him a simple question. Please tell me about, what do you have to say about the wilaya or the spirituality or the status of Ali? He stopped for a second. And he said something which I'll try to translate. He said Ali himself was not the Wali. And I was a bit shocked what he's about to say because he claimed to be from a Sufi tradition. And then he said, no, Ali is the one who, since day one after Islam, is the one who is tasked to distribute the status of spirituality to everyone. So Ali is the giver of wilaya. So he said, no one can claim to be a Sufi or a mystic unless Ali accepts it and grants it to him. That was a big statement. And I said, wow, look at that. So that's why I've picked poetry, because poetry is the true reflection of the Muslim mind and those Muslims who are really deep into the mystical dimension and the spirituality of Islam. So I thought this combination will help me make my case more effectively.
And aside from the Quran and poetry, the amount of research that went into this book is unbelievable. Can you talk a little bit about your research for this book?
Thank you so much. Because I knew that because of the modern day sectarian tendencies, most of the sects are deeply busy with just confronting each other and getting everything changing or converting everything into a debating context. And I said, I thought that the references that I will use will have to be the most authentic. And I also knew I'll not go very far by only using references from one sect. So I initially made a claim in the book that I will mention most of the things only which the facts which are not only incontrovertible, but also a common tendency. So if I'm looking at Sahih Sitta, I'm also looking at Sheikh Mufid. And then that was easier said than done. I realized that meant that I had to look at the Sunni Hadith, which is also Shia Hadith. I mean, that's not, cannot, should not be called only Sunni Hadith, the six great books. But then four or five major books from the Shia tradition, Sheikh Mufid, and other Tusi, the two books, and the great important scholarship, and of course all the statements and hadiths from the 12 Imams in the Isnashri 12 tradition. Also, I looked at the Ismaili tradition, found amazing things. And then my challenge was, okay, this is the religious scholarship, I have to go to the historians also, to Tabri, and on the Shia side, to many of the leading Shia writers. And actually, the tragedy was, in many cases, there are some leading writers who had a tendency of leaning towards Ali, and they were, historians call them Shia, and they were not Shia. They were mostly from the Sunni tradition, but just because it became such a confrontational scholarly environment during historical eras, during Ottomans and even Safavids as well, that even normal ordinary things were made controversial. So I thought the only way I can defeat that sectarianism is by picking up sources from the Hadiths, the both Shia and Sunni historians. And then I came to the contemporary scholarship, and I picked about 30 scholars. The book mentions all those 30 scholars. So, at one point, when even I had finished the book, I realized I had decided to look into the works of 30 people. I've read many of those, or glanced through all, but I'm quoting only about 15 of those. And I said, no, when I'm saying I benefited from these 30, I went back, set aside my manuscript, read new works, and unless and until I realized that I'm reflecting the opinions of almost all those in some shape or form, I thought my narrative will not be completed. So, and in many cases, what happened was that I would be, COVID era helped me a lot, I must say, because that allowed me, I mean, it's tragic as it is, because so many people lost so many family members. It has been a tragedy which is still unraveling, but it allowed some scholars like me and you and others to actually sit at home, and rather than traveling and teaching, we are teaching also, it's the same screen you're teaching in front of. So that and that helped me understand why my effort in the previous 3 years, 2017 to 2020, I was very slow. I was reading a lot, but was not able to write. These 2 years, mostly the whole of 2020, and allowed me to sit and read those works. And many days would go by without me writing anything, or maybe one paragraph in 3 days, because I would look at a new book. And that I would found it so intriguing and so much with new materials that I thought I need to read the whole book. And then maybe two instances come out of it. And I wanted to build that story. And I hope I'm able to build that story because many people, my children, I think, aside from the research work that I did, was another critique was from my immediate family. I have three, I'm blessed with three daughters, all grown up now, but they were during COVID, they were at home as well with my wife. And it was good to have four women actually look at everything, because they were constantly asking me from most biographies, why is Fatima missing? And I realized, for instance, Bibi Fatima bint Asad, the mother of Ali. And she was such an important personality, because not only she was Ali's mother, she's the one who groomed the Prophet. Prophet grew up in the hands of Fatima bint Asad, Ali's mother. And when I started looking at materials about her, I couldn't find anything. Then I found a PhD dissertation on Fatima bint Asad, which is, I think, available on the web, which is referenced in the book as well. I looked at two or three other books, and I built that story. I owe not many of those things, of other women personalities as well in the book, to my family, who were this constant critics at dinner table. So every dinner time was a conversation on that. So it is a combination of hopefully this scholarship that is produced, and also a discussion among young Muslims who were talking to their other friends. And last but not the least, the research also included conversations with Muslims, both Shia and Sunnis. I would write a chapter and then invite two or three of friends from one sect at times together as well. I would test my theories. I have many interesting stories, which if there's time, I can share of how kind of a strong feedback I would get. At times, people would stop talking to me, and then I would have to tell them, look, I was just testing. This is a tentative conclusion on a certain aspect of Imam Ali's life. Don't feel offended. I'm trying to really go deep and think through and also see what sounds logical and rational or not. So don't feel bad. So there was that kind of interaction, because a lot of what is believed about Ali, especially in the Sufi tradition and partly in Shia tradition as well, is verbal history, is oral history. It's you'll not find those in the books, or you'll find it in some archaic book, hard to find. But people are so sure about those facts. And I at times had to ask them, where you heard it from? For instance, one of the, I'm sorry for a long answer maybe to your question. It's okay. There's one story which I mentioned earlier in the book by a Pakistani scholar called Masnavi Maula Ali. Treatise in the praise of Ali by he was a Sunni scholar, and he wrote it in the shape of a poetry. The whole book about Ali is in the form or shape of a poetry, and it's a poetic discourse. And I found a story, a very story that stunned me and surprised me, because not that I claim that I knew everything about Ali, but the story was so powerful and I had never heard it before. And throughout my life, I lived in Pakistan mostly, but then in England, and then last 20 years in US, in three different cities. In Pakistan also, I lived in various towns and cities. I've always visited both the Shia and the Sunni centers. Full disclaimer, my father was a Shi'i, my mother was a Sunni. So we had to often go to both the schools of thought and both Islamic centers. The family was also divided in half and half. So it was interaction throughout life with both traditions. And I think I borrowed and I benefited hugely from both Shi'i and Sunni traditions. And in my later part of my life, because of a spiritual master, a Sufi spiritual guide helped me tremendously. So I at least got a little flavor from all these ideas. So I wanted to reflect all those ideas. And when I would talk to different groups, they would give me different ideas. So this Masnavi Maula Ali, which I want to mention very briefly, has a story which says that the Prophet, peace be upon him, when he was called for Miraj, when he went to heaven, the famous story which is in Quran as well, which is a Miraj in Nabawi, a very important aspect of Islamic history, when he was called upon by the God. And so this book, Masnavi Maula Ali, says that when the Prophet went in front of the God, God gave him a gift at the end of this meeting, a face-to-face meeting in a sense, which even according to Quran, it's a beautiful way the Quran talks about this, how close were Prophet and God. Kaaba Qausain, that verse. And when God says to the Prophet, this is a gift to you, and it is called in Urdu or Farsi, it is called Kharkai Fakar, which I have translated as a cloak of spirituality, or a cloak of spiritual excellence. So the Prophet brings it back. According to the tradition in this book, the Prophet calls his four friends without naming them. The book is not mentioning the four names except one, Ali's name. We know Ali was among the four, but we don't know who the other three were. And the Prophet says, I'm going to transfer this Kharkai Fakar, or cloak of spirituality, to one of you. But there's a test that you have to go through. Tell me, if I give this very powerful thing to you, what are you going to do with it? How will you use this great power and spirituality? So the first person says, the first companion says, I will use it for charity. I will give a lot of charity. The second person says, I'm going to go and win over more lands, or acquire more lands for the Muslims. The third one says, I am going to proselytize. I'm going to go across the world taking the message of Islam and converting people, or introducing the beautiful message of Islam. Then comes the turn of Ali. And Prophet says, what are you going to do? And I'm now short of words, but what I remember is Ali said, I'm going to hide people's mistakes. I'm going to, in a sense, cover up. Indirectly saying, I'm not going to expose people's mistakes. I'm going to help them cover those, or I'm going to ignore. And the Prophet said, yes, Ali, that's the answer I was looking for. The cloak of spirituality is given to you. I have mentioned this story to so many audiences, both in Shia and Sunni, and they all mostly get stunned, especially Shias, because Shias have not heard about it, and in most cases. And when I read it in that book, I started researching what is the source, why in all my with having connection with both the Shia and Sunni tradition, why I have not heard this before. And I realized, because when I went to the writer, God bless his soul, Fazli Haq, was already had expired, but I knew his son very well. I talked to him and others, and then I ultimately found a Sufi scholar in New York, actually, Mr. Saklan, who I asked. I said, I know, Sayyid, you are a spiritual master. You talk about, you love Imam Ali. He's from a Ahle Sunnah or Sunni tradition. I said, have you heard of this? He said, of course. We use it in all our speeches in the Sufi tradition. And I realized neither the Sunnis nor the Shias have heard it often because of their own reasons, which are, I'll not go into those details. But I said, because the message is so powerful, we often focus so much on other aspects, this human-to-human relationship, this helping other people or giving them a chance. I mean, I read this statement of the reason in so many different ways. Ali was just saying, I'm not going to do the backbiting. I'm not going to expose people's faults. I'm not going to kind of pick on people's mistakes and then misuse and manipulate those. I'm going to help them get another chance. I'm not going to give a bad name to my friends and people. I mean, there are so many words in which we can explain. And I said, this is a trait which is so important and which is unfortunately so widespread. And maybe no one wants to acknowledge that how central is this small, simple message that in the God's eyes or in the Prophet's eyes, that's the most important thing. So those kind of stories I also was able to add. And so this research of this the oral history, talking to people also played a very important role.
So before we get directly into the biographical details of Imam Ali's life, could you, and you do this so beautifully in the book, could you talk about the world that Imam Ali was born into?
Sure. I mean, he was, in a spiritual sense, this is the most privileged setting with his parents, Abu Talib and Fatima binti Asad, at that moment of Ali's coming in this life, linked to the Prophet. They were the ones who were taking care of the Prophet. The Prophet, Muhammad, peace be upon him, at that time had not announced his prophethood. That was still about 10 years away. But that's the time when in the ordinary society, there's this all this entrenched tribalism. There is deep-rooted political controversies. There's infighting. There is Arab. It was a thriving trade center, and Kaaba was also the black cube that we see as the center of Islamic pilgrimage in Mecca. Was there people coming from everywhere? But also this place was kind of cut off from the rest of the world at that time. So, but there was this huge gap also, or this need for a spiritual awakening, which was also taking root because of the internal battles, crime, violence. There was this chaos, a confusion worse confounded, I would say, which had also pushed people to their edges. And in that environment, the world was getting ready, or this region was getting ready for the final prophet. And the message was well known among the very, very knowledgeable. For instance, we read about Salman al-Farsi, or now called Salman al-Muhammadi also in Iraq, because he's buried there, was now traveling from across the world through priests. He was getting the spiritual message through the Christian priests at that time, who were giving him this lesson that, yes, we know that a prophet is to come. And because the spirituality in those churches was also very strong. But the message that everyone knew in the Jewish tradition as well. So it was that environment, an environment which is pregnant with hope, but also very divisive, very tainted at its core as well. So that's the environment, and where when Ali comes in, he actually is, as I tell the story in the book, and which is a very based on authentic Muslim tradition from all sides, is that Ali was born in Kaaba, and that's whether you look at the poetry of belonging to any group, it's so much of an accepted fact that Ali was born in Kaaba, which is in itself a huge distinction. But when Ali comes out, he opens his eyes in the hands of the Prophet. So the world he comes in is very divisive, very broken, very truncated. But also, he had the greatest privilege to be in the hands of the Prophet, and then he's groomed by the Prophet. We read this tradition in Islamic history of Prophet even much before that he announces his prophethood, or Gabriel visits him. Even before that, he used to walk up the mountain of the cave of Hira. And when it was not alone that he would go, the Prophet, one few people know that actually who had shown the Prophet the light, who had shown the Prophet the way to that cave? His grandfather, Abdul Muttalib. That was, I had to do on this one small point, a lot of research, that it was, the spirituality was in the family. Whether it was Abdul Muttalib or Abu Talib or Abdullah, they were all very, very gifted people because the final Prophet had to come in this family. So Abdul Muttalib used to go for his kind of spiritual isolation at times, prayers. He had shown that to the Prophet. When the Prophet Muhammad used to go up, he would take his wife Khadija and the small child Ali. So Ali used to go with him. So the world that Ali came into was so powerful in a spiritual sense. And that's why later on Ali had said in his discourse that he said, I know the context and timing and reference of every verse that came to the Prophet, because he was always with the Prophet. He was his right-hand man. He was his assistant. He was his, in a sense, when I say closest friend, people get a little jittery and think, okay, no, Abu Bakr was the best friend. Abu Bakr was also a very good friend. It's not always to say when... So Ali was more of the right-hand man, the assistant, the heir. And think of that moment, which explains the world Ali has come into, which is Ali's hardly, I think, 10 or 11 years of age, when the Prophet got the message and he invited his close family friends. And in those closest family friends were all his uncles and cousins and the closest family members. And the Prophet tells them, he tells Ali, actually, the young Ali, please arrange for food. And the food is prepared. And on the first day, when the Prophet is about to give the message, everyone had their food. They saw there's something strange happening. They left. The second day, again, they were called. The third day, Prophet made a good decision. He said, okay, I'm going to talk first and then offer food. So everyone stayed for food. And that's when the Prophet gave the message and said, I want to introduce you to this one God, who's all supreme and all powerful. And everything in this world is his creation. He's the sovereign. And I'm here to convey the message to you about the Tawheed, of the oneness of God. And then he said, I am his representative here. I am the Prophet. And at that moment, he said, I want help from all of you. And no one raised their hand or offered assistance. When twice or thrice the Prophet said, Ali, as a 9 or 10 year old, just raised his hand and says, Prophet, I'm going to help you. And that's when Abu Hisham, and the most authentic original biography of the Prophet, says, I mean, it's so insightful. As soon as the Prophet heard, he never said, oh, you're a child, he's a kid. Prophet said, oh, okay, from now you are my supporter and you are my heir. These are the words, that's where, from where I take the title. There's no dispute on the translation. I don't know why those who have issues with my title, the Prophet's heir, are not looking into the source from where I'm borrowing this. The Prophet has so clearly mentioned in the very, very first major Islamic event. So the point I'm referring to is Ali from day one has come into a world where with every passing year, or maybe every passing month, there's a new spiritual excellence that awaits him. And his closeness to the Prophet, introducing him to this spiritual world from the very childhood, from the very word go. And that's the strength of Ali, which no one else can be compared with. I mean, no one else, irrespective of their importance of spirituality or their contributions of all the companions of the Prophet, they're all honorable. But no one can match Ali because the kind of background from birth to before his even getting becoming an adult, his childhood is that of not only closeness to the Prophet, but of this constant spiritual teaching that he's getting from the Prophet. That is unparalleled.
So let's stick with this topic of Imam Ali's childhood. And in this second part of the interview, I'd like to talk about Imam Ali and his various roles. So can we start off with maybe talking a little bit about Imam Ali as a son?
Absolutely. Imam Ali as a son, I would say, I mean, one, he, of course, was biologically son of Abu Talib and Fatima bint Asad. But he also, let me say this, was also son to the Prophet, in a sense. And the reason was also that not only that, because the Prophet owed a lot to Abu Talib and to Fatima bint Asad, Abu Talib Ali's father, who had taken the responsibility to groom the Prophet. In fact, Ali's father was the chief protector of the Prophet. The Prophet was saved so many times, not only saved, but groomed and cared for by Abu Talib, that Abu Talib and Fatima bint Asad basically served as the parents of the Prophet. Early on, there was, whether because of the economic, some challenge or some other issues, Abu Talib was in a difficult position. So the Prophet had asked for Ali to adopt him. So just to help his uncle and his almost parents, so that they may be able to deal with the financial situation. In fact, actually different uncles took care of all the brothers of Ali as well, Aqil and Jafar as well. So Ali was adopted by Khadija and the Prophet. So Ali, in that sense, is also the serving as the son of the Prophet. And Prophet had lost one of his child earlyhood, as an infant. Khadija had lost a baby, and she was, of course, that was not easy for her. And that was also the moment that Prophet committed to Abu Talib that he would help him by taking care of Ali. So Ali became, in that sense, the offspring of the son of the Prophet. So he performed both the roles in an extraordinary fashion, standing by the Prophet for a variety of reasons. He, as his successor and heir as well, but also in his role as a son, I would say. This is not how most Muslims would explain this relationship. I'm fully aware of this, but that's something to think about, because that's how Ali was groomed in that household. And this is how he looked at Khadija. This is also the way he looked at Fatima bint Asad. And the Prophet, just to for comparison purposes, for Prophet, Fatima bint Asad was an extremely important lady. The day she died, the Prophet was there. He gave his own shirt to be used in her, the cloth in which she was buried, Fatima bint Asad. So Ali had seen how people around him, including the Prophet, especially the Prophet, I should say, were dealing with their elders. So Ali lived up to that teaching in the best way possible.
And you also mentioned his brothers. Could we talk about Imam Ali as a brother?
Absolutely. Especially the two brothers, actually, both were very accomplished and both played a very important role in Islamic history. Jafar and Aqil. Especially Jafar is called Jafar al-Tayyar. He died in a very important battle. And the Prophet said that he is a martyr. And he's, Prophet had said, I see him flying, in fact, with two angels. That's how his name, if I remember correctly, that's why he was called Jafar al-Tayyar, Jafar who's flying. Ali was very upright as well. The one event that is coming into my mind, that one of the brothers, not Jafar, Aqil, came to Ali. Aqil was in some financial distress, and Aqil came to Ali when Ali was the caliph, as the fourth caliph of Islam. And in his early days, then Akhil comes to Ali and says that, look, I am going through a financial difficult situation. I want you to help me through the treasury. And you are the caliph. You have all the money in your hands. I need it. And Ali looked at him. Ali showed him there was a coal or there was a burning fire with wood. Ali showed him and he said, should I push you in it? He said, what do you mean? Why you want to push me into the fire? Ali said, that's what you want to happen to me. You're asking me to take money from the treasury, which is owned by the people or by the state. You want me to be corrupt and give this to you? And he totally declined him. In fact, Akhil was very much annoyed from him, but for some time, and went to the other camp in Muawiyah's camp, according to some tradition as well, for a short while. But then when Muawiyah, the governor in Damascus, tried to manipulate the situation, Akhil could read the situation and came back. The point I'm making, Ali was very true to his principles. Ali would go, and at that time also, what Ali said to Akhil was, well, I cannot give you anyone else's share, but here is my share as a citizen, because Ali had made a new policy, or he had reverted to the old policy of the Prophet. And also, I think history tells us of the first caliph, that every single penny or whatever the currency, the gold or silver that was in the ownership of the state or the caliph was distributed equally among everyone. The policy had changed at the time of somewhat towards the end of the second caliph's time and the third caliph, that those who had become, who had joined Islam early on were given privilege or some special tribes, especially Banu Umayyah or Umayyads were giving more privileges. But Ali had reverted to the policy that everyone will receive equal share. That's why Ali said to Akhil, look, I cannot give you anything from the treasury. However, I can give you my own share. And he gave his own personal share to his brothers. So Ali was, yes, as a brother, Ali was cognizant of his responsibilities, but he would not violate law for anyone, or he would not violate his principles for everyone. He was serving, he was a brother to every Muslim in that sense also. That's what comes to my mind at this point.
And how about Imam Ali as a husband?
Oh, that's, I think, in so many ways, the most important aspect. I mean, he had the privilege of being the husband first and foremost of Bibi Fatimatu Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet. And that's so such an important and central relationship. We know that Bibi Fatimatu Zahra is the lady of the heaven, or she's the lady who's the in this, according to Islamic tradition and hadith, she is the leader of women in heaven, and her sons Hassan and Hussein are the leaders of men or young men. Everyone will be young in heaven, so basically leader of every man in heaven. So this family is so special, the Ahlul Bayt, the five. And Fatima is at the core of it. And Fatima is also this famous prayer, Hadith-e-Kissa, which is also referenced through Quran, mentioned in Quran in detail. But then there's a prayer and a special event where the status of the Ahlul Bayt, the five, are really elevated. And when this actually Hadith-e-Qudsi as well. Hadith-e-Qudsi means a saying, a divine messaging, but it is coming from the prophets, from the prophet, but it's not part of the Quran per se. And that was when the whole five family members, including the prophet, were introduced. They were introduced through Fatima. When somebody asked, who is in this group under the cloak, Hadith-e-Qissa, the cloak of Qissa, it is said, it is Fatima, her father, her husband, her sons. So there's more to Fatima than I think what we know of. There's this mystery and legend and secrecy as well, in a positive sense, that's so important. Ali, I think that was Ali's greatest privilege. In fact, it is said if there was no Ali, there would have been no one who could have been equal to Fatima in a sense of becoming her life partner. So And Ali's love for his family, especially for Fatima, I think was one of the key points of early Islamic history. Whether it was about bonding, whether it is about sacrifice, whether it is about standing up for the Prophet, whether it is about giving everything for the cause of Islam. It was that beautiful combination of Ali and Fatima. Ali was not only totally dedicated to Fatima, but Ali, I think, was drawing a huge support from Fatima. Without Fatima's support, in many cases, her advice and guidance as well. That was so critical and crucial for Ali. So that relationship, in this sense, his relationship, love, and closeness, and sincerity, and loyalty to Fatima, was the hallmark of all that Ahlul Bayt stands for.
And now you've mentioned the five, and the five being the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, Imam Ali, Bibi Fatima Tazara, and Ali and Fatima's two sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein.
Exactly. Thank you.
And so now would be, I think, the ideal time to speak a little bit about Imam Ali as a father.
True. That too is not only so important, but also reminds us of the great tragedy of Islam in Karbala as well. What Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein had done, actually, they both apparently responded to the challenges in a slightly different way. And I'm only mentioning it because it was all linked to the training and the guidance and apprenticeship of Ali. Hassan, after Ali's martyrdom as caliph in the mosque, Hassan had become the caliph for a short time, maybe 4 to 6 months. And ultimately, Hassan had opted for a negotiated peace deal, so to say, whereas Hussein had stood up and challenged the oppression and reacted and responded through defiance, which led to the tragic story of Karbala. But it was for both of them were right in their own way. The way they reacted and responded to the bigotry and oppression of the times, both for them at the core of their actions was the teachings of the Prophet, peace be upon him, because Hassan and Hussein had they grew in the hands of the Prophet also. But it was the guidance and the way Ali nurtured them by instituting not only the central principles of Islam, but also this feeling that they have to do is to sacrifice and establish their loyalty and pay back in a sense to what status they have been given by God. And it was Ali who throughout the time after Fatima died very young, Bibi Fatima Zahra. So Hassan and Hussein Ali married again. There are different traditions, but Ali married four times. During the time that he was married to Fatima, that was the only relationship he had. But after Bibi Fatima Zahra's death, Ali married thrice again. In some traditions more, but thrice is the most authentic one. And there were more children Ali had also. Some people say 20, some say more than that. But Ali, each one of Ali's children were a reflection of not only his piety and spirituality, but his wisdom and his bravery as well. But that was not reflected better than through what happened through the actions of Hassan and Hussein. So Hassan and Hussein, both imams in the Shi'i tradition as well, but also in the Sunni tradition. I'm reminded of my recent visits to Turkey, but the most recent one. In fact, when I first talked to you, I was in Turkey a few weeks ago. Every mosque, almost every mosque that you go to in Turkey, and Turkey is a majority Sunni, but there's a small, not small, I think 15 to 20% Shia tradition as well, or Alevis as well in addition. But every mosque you go to, I mostly had a chance to go to Sunni mosque, every mosque says, Ya Hassan, Ya Hussein. So in the Islamic tradition, of the Sunni tradition as well, the idea of Ahlul Bayt or Panjtan, as we say in Urdu and Persian, of as you rightly reminded the audience about Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Hassan and Hussein, they are the center of the Islamic universe. And Hassan and Hussein took the legacy not of the Ali, but of the Prophet, because Ali was not teaching them about his own legacy per se. The legacy of this family, the legacy of Hassan and Hussein or any Imam, is actually linked to the Prophet. Ali is just the link, the bridge, which is keeping alive the message and the spirituality and the central principles of Islam. So Ali's task was, I mean, Ali, look at how busy Ali was from his work during the time that others were caliph, but he was supporting them either through advice, at times in the Sunni tradition as a chief judge, but consistently working also. Ali was linked with a lot of initiatives in the agriculture side. He was also linked with establishing many areas, calculating the distances, the major roadways, not in the modern sense, but the pathways at that time. But also, every religious matter would come to Ali whenever Abu Bakr, Umar, Usman were faced with any challenge about religious message or Quran. They were being very honest. They knew, Ali knew much more than them. And they would always refer them to Ali. So it was widely known that on any critical, difficult, sensitive matter, on spirituality, on Quran, on the legacy of the Prophet, on the matters of what Prophet had said, Ali was the chief source. So Ali was extremely busy. Islam was expanding during the time of the first three caliphs. And then Ali becomes the caliph, mostly spent for his 4 years with the three big enemies of Khawarij, of the internal dissension led by wife of the Prophet and some of the close companions who were all Muslims, believed the other side was mistaken. But then Ali was very busy with Khawarij, with the governor of Damascus, Muawiyah, who was a master politician, who was greedy after power, and he never wanted to submit to the acknowledged, accepted caliph. So Ali was extremely busy, but I have not read it anywhere, history has not recorded at any point that Ali failed to play his role as a parent as well. I mean, in the midst of all these roles, as caliph, as somebody who's fighting opposition, as acting as a chief judge, going through very difficult times. Ali, during the first three caliphs, also had to go some tough times as well, politically, both and also in a social sense. But his priority was his family. And this is another message which is so central, but which is often ignored. The importance and centrality of your immediate family. If you are very pious and if you are a great leader whatsoever, but if you are failing when it comes to your immediate family, that's a failing that is not acceptable. That's the message that comes out of Ali. You cannot compromise or give up or sacrifice one important responsibility for the sake of other. And that's what Ali proved. That was reflected through when we saw Hassan and Hussein. I mean, Hussein's contribution and legacy. It was Ali speaking. It was Ali sacrificing his family. That's what Hussein lived up to. Without the Fatima and Ali's teaching, Hussein would not have had that kind of knowledge, wisdom, his capacity to sacrifice him and his family. People can sacrifice themselves. Sacrificing your own family, the most privileged family in a spiritual sense, getting killed and massacred at the hands of the Caliph of Islam at that time, it was not easy. It was Ali's wisdom and the clarity of faith that was instilled in Hussein and Hassan's heart. That you have to give credit to Ali and Fatima for that.
Professor Abbas, this book is spectacular. And we've been talking for almost an hour, and we haven't even scratched the surface of so much of what you have managed to pack in here about the biography of Imam Ali. This is a wonderful book. I really, really encourage listeners to buy it, read it, read it again, read it again. It's absolutely wonderful. Unfortunately, I don't think we have time for many of the other questions I had. But of course, there is a tradition here on the New Books Network, which is asking the author if they could share what they're working on now. So, Professor Abbas, can you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, very briefly. And I'm thankful to my publisher, the same publisher, Yale University Press, that they have in principle agreed to publish my next book, and which I've started working on. Still, I have to have the contract in hand, but I'm close to it, I hope, which is a biography of Bibi Fatimatu Zahra. And that will be even a tougher job than this one. As you know, I'm not qualified as a religious scholar, but I want to write something like this book for ordinary general audience also. Supported by authentic sources and being true to history and try to be above any sectarian divisions. I want to give a common narrative which helps all of the people to connect. That was the message of the Ahlul Bayt. So I hope, and I need support and prayers from all listeners, and support also in terms of research and ideas to start working on the book on Bibi Fatima Zahra. That's the next project, the wife of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib.
I'm sure I speak for everyone when I say that we're all looking very much forward to reading that book. And hopefully you can come back on the show, God willing.
I would love to. I'm so grateful for this opportunity and for your very thoughtful questions. I'm so thankful.
The book is The Prophet's Heir, published in 2021 with Yale University Press. Professor Hassan Abbas, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.